Blog Talk Radio.
After 12 long years after directing the highest grossing film of all time, James Cameron returns to feature filmmaking with one of the most hotly anticipated and wildly gossiped about films of the decade, Avatar. This is Movie Geeks United, and we welcome you as we delve into this groundbreaking project with one of the film's co-stars, Stephen Lang, and James Cameron biographer, Rebecca Keegan. My name is Jamie.
And my name is Jerry. Welcome to the show. We've been gone for a while, but we missed all of you.
Yeah, we sure did. Jerry, we've talked about Avatar a lot.
Yeah, we have.
On this show. So how do you feel now that we're in the home stretch?
Well, I think this is it. I think this is the big movie. This is possibly, you know, this could very well be the movie of the decade. He could have really, I mean, this really could be the, I mean, I hate to use the phrase game changer, but I think it is a game changer, it sounds like. Everything changed as of last Thursday when the reviews started coming out, and people who were not looking forward to it or weren't crazy about the trailer really changed their tune, and really said it was just, it was incredible,
yeah.
To put it mildly.
Well, I put together some of these reviews. Let's talk, let's mention these reviews. Variety says this: Cameron delivers again with a film of universal appeal that just about everyone who ever goes to the movies will need to see. The Hollywood Reporter says Cameron once again proves he is king of the world. USA Today says the first sight of this exotic paradise, Pandora, may rival the seminal scene in The Wizard of Oz when the Technicolor Munchkin world first comes into focus. And Roger Ebert said, watching Avatar, I felt sort of the same as when I saw Star Wars in 1977.
Wow.
You can't ask for...
Yeah, I mean, you really can't. So this could overshadow everything.
I mean, those are like superlatives.
Yeah.
And there have been some reviews that have pointed out weaknesses. And the weaknesses that they point out are indicative of a lot of the weaknesses that these same critics point out in other Cameron movies.
Right.
But by all accounts, this is an experience that everyone needs to see, and it could change movies and definitely be the biggest movie story of this decade, as Titanic was the last.
Mm-hmm.
But every write-up about this movie, every conversation about this movie in the trades, and I don't know so much that fans care,
right,
but everyone seems to focus on the cost, the price tag associated with Avatar.
Yeah, that just become, I think, commonplace just with Cameron in general, you know, just the price tag. I mean, they just all sort of harp on that ever since Terminator 2 it cost $100, was the most expensive movie at its time, and they all focus on that, and then, you know, so I don't think he can ever escape that.
Yeah, he's made the most expensive movie ever made several times.
Yeah, he keeps breaking that ceiling.
Is that a fair conversation to have concerning the movie?
Look, I mean, there are a lot of great movies that never make their money back. He is not that. I mean, I think The Abyss, you know, I think we did find out The Abyss actually did, you know, break even. But for the most part, all of his movies have, you know, made more than the thing. But is it a fair conversation? No, it's not. I don't think so.
Well, Cameron did an interview posted today, and he said it doesn't mean jack. He said, first of all, if you're talking about how expensive the movie is, then it should be a real value for the paying customer, because they're paying the same price they would to watch a $20 million movie.
Yeah.
So they're getting more bang for their buck, which is a nice way of looking at it.
Yeah, no, that is a good way to look at it. So
yeah, but he can't escape that, and also the technical wizardry that is associated with all of his films.
Mm-hmm.
But they're never at the sake of character, or story, or emotion. Mm-hmm. I don't find, and we're going to talk about all of his films after we play this first interview. You want to get to our first guest?
Yeah, let's do it.
Okay, Rebecca Keegan. Her new biography on James Cameron is now available for purchase, and you can do so right here on our homepage. Just click the Futurist icon, and it'll take you to Amazon where you can buy it. In The Futurist, The Life and Films of James Cameron, Ms. Keegan dissects the creative mind and unique daredevil spirit that make James Cameron one of the most exciting, cutting-edge filmmakers the medium has ever witnessed. Ms. Keegan is a contributor to Time magazine. She's covered the Oscars, Sundance, and Comic-Con, and she's covering the awards season for Vanity Fair. And in fact, just today, she published a wonderful article at Vanity Fair concerning Cameron's groundbreaking female characters. And we discuss those female characters in this interview and a whole lot more. Enjoy. I wanted to know why you chose Cameron as a subject.
Well, thanks. Yeah, I think James Cameron is utterly fascinating, and I first met him, I had done a short phone interview with him, but the first time I met him was when I visited the Avatar set in early of 2008, and at the time there was still a shroud of secrecy surrounding the movie, and I really had no idea what to expect, but I pulled into this dingy warehouse in LA and went inside, and there were a few guys working on computer monitors off in the corner, and then there was this big, empty, gray soundstage, and it was Cameron and a computer and a camera, and that was it. And he was holding the camera, and to me it was amazing because, as you guys know, first of all, directors don't hold cameras, not elite directors like Cameron anyway, but it looked to me like this totally postmodern play that was being shot. It didn't look like some big budget studio movie until he let me look inside his camera lens and see this whole world of Pandora. And at that point I thought, you know, this is going to be a fascinating movie to watch how they make it. And this guy seems to only do things that are hard. I'm going to try and stick around if they'll let me.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I know that you've covered Fanboys and you've talked about written about Comic-Con and different trends in movies. And Cameron seems to me probably the ultimate movie tech geek in a way, isn't he?
Totally. I mean, Cameron is a giant 14-year-old boy, basically. And he loves nothing more than to completely geek out on technology. I think the people he looks up to most in the world are scientists, which you see a little bit in the characters in Avatar. And, you know, pretty much since The Abyss, he's been coming up with a world in his mind and trying to figure out how to create the technology he'll need to realize that world. And Avatar is really the ultimate expression of that.
Mm-hmm. I think so, too. But he actually gave you his full cooperation for this book, and you spent time with him, speaking to him at length for the book, correct?
Yeah, it took me a while to persuade him. After that first time I visited him, I basically called Lightstorm, his offices, every 2 weeks for about a year, and I would sort of show up where he was making public events where he was. It was a little bit annoying, I think. But yes, when he ultimately sat down and said, okay, Rebecca, you know, you can do this, he was very open. You know, I had a list of about 25 people that were close to him that I wanted his blessing to speak to, and he came back with a list of 50 and
Wow.
allowed me to spend a lot of time on the set at different stages of the production and post-production process, and he was very generous in that way.
Wow. So what surprised you most about him in your discussions with him or your research about him?
Well, I think, you know, everybody knows his reputation for being this sort of artistic tyrant. Mm. And I was very surprised how loyal people are to him and how he seems to inspire people to really do their best work. And I think, yes, he is that guy that you hear about, that guy who's very critical and very intense. But he's also a guy that people seem willing to kind of follow to the end of the earth, whether they're going to the bottom of the ocean or, in the case of Avatar, whether they're creating all this new technology that's hugely complex. One of the sort of set catchphrases that was written on a whiteboard on the Avatar set was, it's Avatar, dude, nothing works the first time. Mm-hmm. And you realize, you know, this is a whole group of people who are making a movie in a way that they had no idea if it was going to work, and they went with him.
You talk about him being a tyrant, an artistic tyrant. But has he mellowed at all? Because there are accounts in the earlier films of that kind of quality that he had. But it seems like he might have mellowed a little bit.
You know, I think it would be hard to use the word mellow to ever describe James Cameron. But I will say, you know, I talked to him about the fact that in these years in between Titanic and Avatar, he spent a lot of time doing these deep sea dives, filming these documentaries, and was often in real life or death situations and having to make decisions about people's safety and do we continue even though there's a hurricane on the way. And he told me that in the process of filming those movies, he started to really change his view about management and about what you do to bring a movie to fruition. And he said it became less about having temper tantrums and the movie is the only thing that matters, and he started to really step back a little bit and take in the larger picture. So I think that changed his management style a little bit.
Yeah. Jerry, were you about to say something and I interrupted? I'm sorry.
You know, sorry. I just wanted, because, you know, I've been reading all this stuff the last couple of weeks about Cameron. I think one of the most important things to realize about him is that he's been gone so long, it was always considered, like, when he returned to narrative filmmaking, it would be something that was worth his while. It would be something that, you, if you were on the crew, you would follow him to the ends of the earth, because here's a guy who's changed. He is a game changer every time he comes out with a movie.
Mm-hmm.
He really sets the bar incredibly high. There have been other people who tried to do that this decade, but it looks like he has come in and really set the world on fire this time.
Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean, if you look at how, I can't think of another director who at the prime of his career, at the peak that Cameron was after Titanic, I mean, he could have really made any movie he wanted to make,
mm-hmm.
would have stepped back and said, you know what, I want to really explore life and I want to think about what I want to do. And it is that kind of feeling that he gets where he's not going to make a movie unless he is going to break new ground. That, I think you're right. I think it inspires people to follow him because they know they're going to be part of something really unique.
Another thing, though, I wanted to ask is, because this is something he was at, one of the reasons he, I remember when The Abyss came out, he made it because he was getting sick of the people saying that he was only obsessed with hardware, like with technology.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd really reached a breaking point, actually, in one of the interviews, and he said, you know, that's not true. That's why I made The Abyss. I wanted to show that I care about characters. And if you look at his other films, he does care about characters. He has some of the best written female characters of all time. He really does care. But I was curious, with this film, since it is so, the technology is so the main event, is he concerned at all that people are just going to label him as a hardware fanatic?
I don't know if he's concerned. You know, that's not something I talked to him about. But you're right about his characters, and I think his female characters in particular are as groundbreaking as his technology. And I just wrote a piece that just went up on VanityFair.com about his female characters. And I think the female characters in Avatar are as forward-looking as Sarah Connor and as Ripley was in Aliens and Lindsay Brigman was in The Abyss. I mean, they're, even if you just look at Sigourney Weaver, I mean, she plays a scientist. The character of Neytiri isn't just a love interest. She has all these other qualities to her, which if you compare it to the other movies in its category, you know, comic book movies, what women get to do in those movies is basically scream and dangle from buildings and be strapped to bombs. I mean, so he's totally in another league when it comes to the attention he pays his female characters.
I think so, too. And I put him up there with Woody Allen, with a penchant for writing female characters,
right,
obviously for a completely different genre of film. But
mm-hmm.
And then I look at...
I would like to see those two work together, actually. I think
yeah.
Woody could help him on his dialogue a little bit.
I think so, too. But and I see his ex-wives,
mm-hmm.
and I think he's very attracted to strong women. And did he have a strong kind of mother presence in his life? Were there a history of being surrounded by strong women that
yeah, I interviewed his mom for the book, Shirley, and she is a spitfire. I mean, Shirley, she was a mother of five, and in Ontario, Canada, in the 1950s, when what women were supposed to do was be homemakers, Shirley had, you know, at that point, three young kids, and she went out and joined the Army and spent her weekends, you know, trooping through fields in the rain and, you know, learning how to assemble a gun blindfolded. She was a painter. She took science classes for fun. I mean, she's really a fascinating woman. Probably in another time would have had an amazing career in some field. And I think Cameron's view of women was really informed by her.
That sounds like Sarah Connor you just described.
She's like Sarah, I told her, I said, you know, you're Sarah Connor trapped in the body of a Canadian grandmother, and she's just, oh no, no, not me, you know.
You'd mentioned the long break. It was kind of a self introspective break that he took after Titanic, and as movie fans at a distance, I was always waiting for the announcement of the next Cameron movie, and my thought was maybe what kind of a role did possibly fear play in that hiatus?
You know, it's interesting. When I asked him about why he took so long, Cameron told me he had no intention of spending that much time sort of out of the mix. Initially, it was that he was going to just take a year or two off and do these documentary projects. And then he had a number of movies that he was working on that didn't come together for one reason or another. Then he decided to move ahead on Avatar, and it was clear that the technology was going to require years to put it together. You know, other people I interviewed, like Peter Chernin, who had been the head of Fox during Titanic, was also, like you, saying, you know, gunning for the next Cameron movie, ready to greenlight it, you know, wanting to go. And everybody was sort of hesitant to try and psychoanalyze Cameron, but he conceded that after a success like Titanic, there can be a feeling of, gosh, how do I follow this?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But with Titanic, and every movie of his is, well, not every film. It's artistically successful, The Abyss, but it didn't make a massive return on its investment, I don't believe. But
The Abyss made back its money, but just barely.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But after you make the biggest movie of all time, and every movie out, all the ink that's dedicated to those movies, inevitably they mention this is the new most expensive movie ever made.
Yeah.
And
right.
He's obviously a man of epic tastes, and he loves the spectacle. But has he ever had a desire to direct a small, more intimate film?
He expresses that desire after every big movie and then never actually makes it.
Mm-hmm.
After Terminator 2, he had a script called The Crowded Room, which was about, which is a great script, actually. You can download it online, and it's about a guy who has multiple personality disorder, which would have been a smaller budget film, which he didn't end up making. And he has another a script that he's got, you know, in his back pocket right now called The Dive, about a couple who are divers that could be a very inexpensive film. Now, whether he'll actually someday make one of those small films, I'd love to see him do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to imagine, you know, if Avatar does well and a sequel rolls along and the train leaves the station, it's hard to imagine him taking the time to do that, but I would like to see it.
You talked about characters and his strength with female characters. What about story? Do you think he's appreciated as a storyteller as much as he should be?
I think Cameron has some incredible strengths as a storyteller, and I think he has some weaknesses. And I think one of his strengths is structure. He's really good. I think Titanic was a beautifully structured script, the kind of way he framed it with the present-day story. I think one of his weaknesses maybe is that he stuffs a lot of story in there, and it, oftentimes too much for the movie. You know, his movies tend to run quite long, and he often finds himself, you know, in this, like, next circle of hell in the editing room, trying to pare them down into something that is a commercial length. So
right.
I do think he's underestimated as a storyteller, and I think if he suffers from anything, it's an abundance of ideas, and sometimes it's hard to sort of cue that in.
I think that's so beautiful, though, because there are so many films that aren't about anything. So
I know.
I'm very thankful that somebody has too many ideas.
I know, me too.
Yeah, and you talked about his dialogue. He admits that his dialogue needs work. I was very surprised. He's very open about that.
Yeah, he at one point I interviewed him about the script he wrote, Strange Days, which Kathryn Bigelow directed. And that's the script where he says he's most proud of his dialogue, and he really worked hard to get a sort of natural-sounding speech. The interesting thing is he takes a lot of knocks for his dialogue, but he also has written some lines that have become the most memorable.
Yeah, that's
you know,
right.
Hasta la vista, baby. And I think there's a great line, actually, in Avatar that Michelle Rodriguez's character says, "You're not the only one with a gun, bitch," which I think is going to be, I think that's going to be, you know, this movie's get away from her, you bitch.
Yeah,
from Alien.
Right. But it also in his films, there is always a sociological message. There's a message underlying, you know, the tremendous action. And that seems to be very important to him. And in Avatar, too, we're hearing about the parallels to Vietnam and Iraq. So that's relevant to his work as well, right?
Right, yeah, and the environment. Yeah, you're never going to see him make a movie like The Hangover that's just about a good time. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with a movie that's just about a good time. I just don't think Cameron has any interest in making one.
Mm-hmm.
And Avatar has a lot of Vietnam imagery in it, in the kinds of equipment and helicopters that they designed. There's lines that seem ripped right from the headlines about shock and awe and the war on terror. And there's also an environmental message that is impossible to miss.
Have you seen Avatar?
I have. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
So, what kind of take do you have on it after you've finally seen the finished product?
I think visually he completely delivered on what he claimed he was going to do. You know, Cameron always makes these bold proclamations, and people, you know, go, "Oh yeah, King of the World, shut up." And the thing is, he delivers, and he did. I mean, Pandora is magnificent. The creatures are wildly fantastical. The plant life, I mean, there's such imagination and thought put into it. I think the story is pretty complicated, and people are going to want to see it, you know, to sort of absorb the story. That was my one concern watching it. It's like, wow, this is a complex story, and it takes a little bit to absorb it. But I think he really did what he said he was going to do, and I think he changed the way movies are going to look.
It seems that it could be similar to Titanic in that it will not be, my opinion, it will not be a one-weekend movie. It'll be something that people hear about. You have to experience this once the public gets in to see it, and people will go on subsequent weekends. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's this enormous gamble? Do you think it's going to pay off?
I think it will pay off. Yeah, I do. I think it will be a little bit different from Titanic. I mean, Titanic was so anomalous. The biggest single ticket sales day for Titanic was Valentine's Day, 2 months nearly after it opened. I mean, that movie just kept going and going and going. And I think Avatar will go for a good long time. It's not going to be a one-weekend movie. But I can't imagine another movie ever sticking around as long as Titanic did.
Well, that had a big female audience, too, that went four or five times. And they're trying to sell Avatar the love story. And I know Cameron says that ultimately this film turned out to be a love story in the end. So I'm wondering if that marketing strategy will stick.
It'll be interesting to see. You know, he says all his movies are a lot of stories, and you really can watch them all that way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the female characters in Avatar are extraordinary, and I think in some ways the trailers don't necessarily play to a female audience. I think if women start going, you know, if they get dragged by their boyfriend and then they go tell their girlfriend, like, no, you know, Michelle Rodriguez's character is a total badass, or Neytiri is actually pretty cool, that it will help how the movie does among women.
Yeah. Well, with the Golden Globes that came out today, we're recording this on a Tuesday when they just came out, I mean, Avatar was well represented. And I know that you cover the award season for Vanity Fair, I believe. So what do you think its chances are in that arena? I'm asking all these questions really selfishly because I'm crazy about Cameron, and I have a $200 bet going. That it's
well,
going to be
you know what? Fox has a much bigger bet than that, so you've got some other people behind you. You know, it'd be interesting to see with the Best Picture category having 10 movies that can be nominated. Be interesting to see if Avatar is nominated in that category. You know, traditionally the Academy is incredibly unimpressed by sci-fi. When Aliens got a number of nominations, including an acting nomination for Sigourney Weaver, it was the first time an actor had ever been nominated for a science fiction film. So, and clearly, I mean, Titanic got a record-tying 11 nominations. Clearly, the Academy has shown that they are willing to give Cameron's movies a serious look. You know, the problem with Avatar is the Academy members are older, and they're actors, a lot of them. And actors are very afraid of CGI, and older audiences are not necessarily interested in a movie that's so heavily CGI. So that'll make it tricky with the Academy. But I think the fact that there's 10 possible best pictures will be helpful for the movie.
I think so, too. And part of what makes this movie unique from an acting standpoint, and I've read, I think Mike Clark wrote something that he thinks that Zoe Saldana should be considered for Best Actress, is that it's really all them in this movie. It's their complete physicality. It's them. Not an animation.
Well, what's interesting, I mean, when you look at Zoe Saldana's performance, it's really both her and, you know, hundreds of guys at Weta Digital in New Zealand manipulating her performance. I mean, yes, it is her, and when she snarls and when she jumps, it's Zoe. But there's also a whole other element to the performance, and I actually wonder if someday there will be a category for this particular kind of performance, because you really should reward both the actor and the army of digital artists who enable the visuals.
Yeah,
I think that she has a shot, because there was a whole movement back in 2002 when The Two Towers came out,
mm-hmm.
For Andy Serkis, for Golem. You know, there's a whole mm-hmm. movement to get him. I think that they've moved, obviously, it seems like the technology is even 7 years later, way more advanced, and it's not insulting to the actor, any actor, really, because you need them to do this. You can't do it without them. I don't think that's something that needs to be stressed to a lot of people. It's not here to replace.
Yeah, Andy Serkis's performance was the breakthrough. I mean, here was a Shakespearean-trained actor, and you could clearly see his face and clearly see his movements in this CG character, and I think that really, you're right, I think that really broke through and showed people that this medium is really a merger of technology and performance.
Yeah. Well, Rebecca, this book is fantastic. It's called The Futurist. It's available on our homepage, where our listeners are tuning into the show for purchase. And I really appreciate your time and giving us the opportunity to geek out about Cameron with you.
Well, thanks. I'm happy to have people to geek out with.
Great.
Thank you.
Take
Thank
care,
you,
guys.
Rebecca.
You too.
Bye-bye. All right. That's Rebecca Keegan. The book is The Futurist. You can purchase it now. And it is a fascinating read on all of his films. And he's always setting the bar so high for himself. And like she said, he always delivers.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah. So I want to talk to you about the other films in Cameron's resume and get your take on them, Jerry, and which ones are particular favorites of yours. But first, let's have a little reminder of the films that populate James Cameron's resume. Here's some clips.
Okay.
I'm a friend of Sarah Connor. I was told that she's here. Could I see her, please?
No, can't see her. She's making a statement.
Where is she?
Look, it may take a while. I want to wait this bench over there.
I'll be back.
Just tell me one thing, Burke. You're going out there to destroy them, right? Not to study, not to bring back, but to wipe them out.
That's the plan.
Zap her again. Do it!
Charge it.
Do it! Charge it.
Come
on, breathe, baby. God damn it, breathe. God damn you, bitch! You never backed away from anything in your life! Now fight! 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 Right now! Do it! Fight, God damn it! Fight!
There's one more chip. And it must be destroyed also. Here. I cannot self-terminate. You must lower me into the steel.
How'd it go at the convention, honey?
You were the big hit of the show.
It's fantastic. I love the computer business.
For 15 years, Harry Tasker's been leading a double life.
Mr. President, one of our best men is inside.
Transmitting now.
Right on time.
I don't believe I've met you before.
Rehnquist. Harry Rehnquist.
Listen to the following code word. Helen. H-E-L-E-N.
Now. They're about to collide.
What's your exit strategy?
I'm going to walk right out of the front gate.
May I see your invitation, please?
Sure. Here's my invitation.
Close. Trust me. I trust you. All right. Close your eyes.
Jake Sully?
I'd like to talk to you about
a fresh start on a new world. You'd be making a difference.
I became a Marine for the hardship. I told myself I can pass any test a man can pass. All I ever wanted was a single thing worth fighting for.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
You should see your faces.
We have an indigenous population called the Na'vi. They are very hard to kill.
This is why we're here. Because this little gray rock sells for 20 million a kilo. Their village happens to be resting on the richest deposit, and they need to relocate. Those savages are threatening our whole operation. We're on the brink of war, and you're supposed to be finding a diplomatic solution.
The concept is to drive the remotely controlled bodies called avatars. They're grown from human DNA mixed with DNA of the natives.
Marine in an avatar body. That's a potent mix.
You get me what I need, I'll see to it you get your legs back. Your real legs.
Hell yeah, sir.
Looks like you. This is your avatar.
Just relax and let your mind go blank. It shouldn't be hard for you.
Cameron's filmography.
You didn't pick Piranha 2, The Spawning.
I made the distinction. Those are the highlights. you remember when The Terminator first came out?
Yeah.
The tremendous buzz about that movie.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think I finally saw it when it came out on tape because I was 13 or something. No, I was 11 when it came out because
I
was 84. But I have this distinct memory, like I was watching 2020, and the Terminator turned out to be this huge phenomenon. This movie made on a low budget that rivaled the bigger budget action pictures for excitement. I remember Hugh Downs on 2020 like saying, "The Terminator, why is it hot?" That's exactly how I said it. And it's one of those memories that sticks in my mind. I guess it's a movie geek memory. But
you're right. No. I'll never think of Hugh Downs the same way ever again.
But it really established Cameron as a unique thinker in kind of the sci-fi action world because it was an ingenious premise.
Oh, yeah, and it's also he found the perfect role for Arnold Schwarzenegger. I mean, it was a stroke of genius. I like Conan, don't get me wrong, but this was the movie that really launched Arnold as an action star. And the world would never be the same again. And their relationship, I think, through the three films, I mean, I would ask to say that Arnold's best work, first and foremost, is for Cameron. I don't think there's any argument there.
His finest work. But and the Terminator was so ideally suited for him because I don't think anyone quite knew what to do with him. Without the Terminator, what kind of film career would he have had? I mean, he was pretty difficult to place.
Yeah,
without...
he couldn't. I mean, the second Conan film was a disaster, and then he had Red Sonja later on. But, you know, there was, let's not forget, there was that movie he made, Stay Hungry, with Jeff Bridges. That was very good, and he was actually got good notices, but that was way before that. But, no, I think the thing with Arnold is very important. But, you know, as you were playing these clips, the thing I couldn't get over is how so few films there are.
Yeah,
that's
true.
The thing that's, like, really kind of shocking, and he's made quite an impact. And if you think about it, let's say the Terminator is, 84?
Mm-hmm.
So, and he hasn't done it.
Well, there's one probably really good reason why there's so few films. Well, first of all, this latest 12-year hiatus.
Yeah.
But also because every time out he's making one of the most difficult movies ever.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I know. That's what I mean. It's just like, it's not that, like, I mean, it is a small filmography, but an intense one. Each film is, you know, an event when it comes out. There's no doubt about that. I was just like, while you were playing, I was like, damn, you know, there's not a lot. As far as quantity, there's not a lot. Quality is another story, but quantity, wow.
And for him to go, he went from Terminator to Aliens, and he didn't have a great experience shooting Aliens. He was in London, and I guess the London crew had no regard for Cameron whatsoever.
That's right.
But what a stunning action movie. And very different from Ridley Scott's Alien.
Mm-hmm.
But it was so good, in no way did that film feel like sacrilege for treading on Ridley Scott's ground.
No. It's, I should say, the Alien movies are unique, the four Alien movies, because they each have a different feel to them, and they don't insult the others. They build upon, I think, what came before. But Aliens is my favorite of the four. Aliens, I mean, it's just I always love going back and watching that one.
Because his concept for that character, Ripley, and where she would be then, was very unique. And that's what drove it. It was very, very emotional and unique, and it does play like a Cameron movie, like a testosterone-filled action movie, as opposed to Ridley Scott's kind of eerie sci-fi horror.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a different creature entirely. And then The Abyss, which is probably the most strenuous, difficult shoot he's done.
Yeah.
The most close calls, the most kind of life-and-death situations. Filming underwater the majority of the film. Ed Harris driving home thinking, oh, God, I wish I was dead now.
That was one of the most difficult films. I remember reading the interviews and everything. People said that was one of the most difficult film shoots they had ever been on.
But he never sacrifices the emotion, as I said before, and this is brought up in the Futurist book that we discussed earlier, because at the center of this huge summer action movie with The Abyss is the story of a crumbling marriage.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's something you don't necessarily expect from that genre of film. So that's definitely relevant to all of Cameron's work.
Yeah, I mean, no, that's very true, because it's also there's the crumb or the deteriorating marriage and True Lies. You have this, and that was, of course, very autobiographical for when The Abyss was being made. He's a very, like you said, a lot of people, like we were talking about this interview earlier, you know, a lot of people want to throw the thing, he's just obsessed with hardware and everything, but there is emotion, there is a very strong narrative behind all those effects. It's not just effects for the sake of effects. There is something else at work there.
And I do think that The Abyss suffered because it was the summer of Batman. I mean, Batman was the huge story.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it had the unfortunate circumstance of coming out.
Look, James Bond suffered
within a few weeks
that.
Of that. Yeah.
I mean, everyone except for Lethal Weapon 2. Everyone else really, and Indiana Jones came out long before that, so that was okay. But you know, everything that came out in the weeks after Batman suffered.
And then Terminator 2. Again, pushing the envelope, showing us things that we'd never seen before, going against against the reigning thought that Schwarzenegger should always be the evil kind of Terminator, turning that on its head.
And that was brilliant to do that.
Brilliant, brilliant. The same as his thought of doing a female, strong female character starting with the first Terminator,
mm-hmm.
and making her very average.
Right.
You know, there was nothing outwardly exceptional about Sarah Connor.
Mm-hmm.
And again, just like he did with Ripley, reconceptualizing that character, maturing that character to the point where she's first seen in Terminator 2, it's a great character development.
Yeah, it is.
And then True Lies for me is a lot of fun.
It is.
But there's a lot of action comedies, and one usually sacrifices over the other. Like, I guess Romancing the Stone you could view as an action comedy. But I always saw Romancing the Stone as more of an action movie. With
right.
True Lies, I see it very equally. I see it a comedy, and I see it as an action movie.
Mm-hmm. No, I see that.
Yeah. And Schwarzenegger's very funny. It doesn't short shrift on the action either, or the elaborate set pieces.
No, there's some great action in there. I mean, some wonderful action pieces in that film.
Tom Arnold, of all people.
That's his finest hour.
Jamie Lee Curtis, another great female character and another brave piece of casting, because you would never expect to see Jamie Lee Curtis.
And don't forget the daughter from the Girl from Dollhouse, Alicia
yeah.
Dushku. So,
yeah.
Everyone's in it.
Which brings us to the behemoth. Titanic.
Yes.
Which we've done a show on Titanic on that film's, was it 10th anniversary?
I believe it was the 10th anniversary, yes.
Yeah, and we talked to an actress from that film who actually auditioned for Sigourney Weaver's part in Avatar and around the time that we were talking to her. But what can you say about Titanic? I think as the years go by, actually it didn't take very long for the backlash to begin on Titanic.
Well, the backlash started, although it seems like backlash has started even now before the movies come out.
Mm-hmm.
I tell you, there's some movies that I like a lot this year that the backlash started while they're still on the festival circuit, it seems like. So
yeah.
I'm not going to go into that right now, but the backlash, Titanic at least made so much money really before the backlash set in. It didn't really matter.
And I think that's part of the backlash.
Yeah.
Yeah, honestly, how damn successful it was.
Yeah.
And it was an anomaly, kind of. It tapped into something where people had to see it 4 or 5 times. That's the only way a movie like that can gross that amount of money.
Right. You might have, I'm not saying it could come close, but or beat it even. But you might have that, because I think people will be so, the smart thing is people want to really go see this in the 3D digital, and if they can go see it in IMAX, they're going to go. And right there, that's a higher ticket price and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to help. So I think they're going to have people wanting to go back and see this. I'm not saying everyone will rush and go back and see it, but I do think there are going to be a sizable group that will say, hey, we've got to see it. We've never seen anything like this.
But Avatar's reception thus far has really mirrored Titanic's, and to a lesser extent, some of the other Cameron films,
mm-hmm.
because Titanic, not the actual Titanic event, but the movie, had disaster written all over it for a lot of people.
Right.
And
it was pushed back from its original release date.
It was pushed back. Everyone knew it was in the daily trades.
Mm-hmm.
Titanic watch. You know, they're this much over budget. They're a month over schedule. What's Cameron doing? He's replicating the damn Titanic. You know, all these eyes for stupid details. Will it come through in the actual movie? Does anyone care? Untested leads
mm-hmm.
for a huge movie like that. And they've become acclaimed, and I would argue that Titanic has a direct involvement in
mm-hmm.
that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's very interesting. Like, a lot of, you know, Leo, the first couple of years, some of the projects were questionable. Then all of a sudden, he starts working with Scorsese and Spielberg at the same time, and just boom, his star just rise. I mean, it's the quality of the work becomes apparent,
yeah.
And you do see, And then Kate Winslet, you know, she took, you know, actually the parts that followed Titanic were very, like, Holy Smoke and Hideous Kinky, and there's some other really small films. And then she, like, in this decade, comes into her own very strongly.
Right. But she had that maturity from the beginning, and there's an interesting point that somebody brings up in this book, that pairing her with Leonardo DiCaprio was brilliant at that time because she brought maturity to him.
Mm-hmm.
And he brought a childish playfulness to her.
Right.
They were kind of a perfect complement to one another in that film. What more can you say about Titanic? People in the chat room are talking about, you know, I cried when I saw it. I'm not afraid to admit it. I cried, actually, I cried when I walked up to the projector room to shut down the projector because we screened it the night before it opened. And That's what it got me, oddly enough. I just have a vivid memory of that. But I was too much kind of in awe of that last hour of the film. It was
just jaw-dropping. Well, his attention to detail was just outstanding. I'm really surprised people, you know, like you say, it is deja vu all over again here. People are, like, you know, really doubting that he, before last Thursday at least, before the screening, everything was like, oh, this is going to be a disaster.
Right.
And then that, geez, when this word, when it got out on Twitter and Facebook and everywhere else, oh my God, the tide really changed.
And he is transferring Titanic to 3D. That's going to be a 2-year process. So in a couple of years, we'll see Titanic in 3D, which will add even more to its gross. But being so heavily supported by the female audience, I'm not sure the 3D is actually a selling point for that audience.
He's really serious. He's going to do that.
He's already been doing it.
Yeah, wow.
He's already in the process.
Because you know
they're converting.
Else?
They're converting a lot to 3D. Actually,
you know who else is converting his films to 3D?
John Holmes.
No. And from the grave. That's impressive. That would be very interesting. Actually, no. The thing is that George Lucas has been talking about doing the original Star Wars trilogy, like redoing it in like 3D. And now there's talk, supposedly, that he is very jealous of what Cameron has done here and wants to make a new Star Wars film, which I think, please don't let that be true.
Please, God, no. But that's an interesting conversation to have, the dynamic between and the similarities and where they differ between Cameron Spielberg, to a lesser extent now Lucas, because Lucas doesn't work as much, but mainly Cameron and Spielberg.
Good thing.
Mainly Cameron and Spielberg,
yeah.
And now Peter Jackson, I suppose with the Lord of the Rings trilogy, even though I don't know that that's where his mind will be at for the majority of his career, that kind of genre, but he comes into play too, and he's very close to Cameron. Let's take a call. We got a call, and then we'll play our next interview. We have a 708 area code. Go ahead.
Hello, this is Ike from OSLCX.
Hey, buddy, how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm glad you guys are doing this thing to James Cameron. I just thought I'd share four facts with you about things you may not have known about James Cameron. If you don't mind?
Sure.
Okay. The first one is I'm not sure if it was either the first Terminator or Aliens, but he actually wrote the original draft for the second Rambo movie.
Yeah, he did.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, and he wrote the action, but Stallone did the politics thing. And the second fact is that he was one of the inspirations for the design for the Predator monster, because he was on a plane with Stan Winston, and he went up to him and he said, you know, I always wanted to have a monster with mandibles, and that gave to Stan Winston the influence to create the design for the Predator, because the original monster was a kind of a cockroaching-looking thing, and Jean-Claude Van Damme was actually one of the stuntmen in the suit.
Wow. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
And the last two facts I wanted to share, I'm not sure if you remember this, James Cameron was originally supposed to direct the Spider-Man movies.
That's right.
And the last fact, I think he was supposed to direct the remake of Planet of the Apes before the Tim Burton.
Yeah, everyone was attached. Like Oliver Stone was attached to one at one time too.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, you know, what's interesting with Spider-Man, a couple of these facts that you mentioned. Spider-Man, Stan Lee. Right, Stan Lee, creator of Spider-Man?
Yeah.
He was crazy about Cameron's treatment that he wrote for Spider-Man.
Yeah.
He said it was true to what he had created, and yet it added a whole new dimension to it. Cameron was the one that had the idea for Peter Parker's web shooters to actually be part of his body, that his body changed. Mm-hmm. They weren't something made or fabricated by Peter Parker. And that remained in there. And he was really kind of sour over Spider-Man, that he didn't get a story credit, because they used a lot of his elements in it.
Yeah, there's very interesting stuff there.
Yeah. And actually, to tell you what kind of a geek he is, he worked with NASA. He would go to NASA. He really wanted to do a big Mars movie, which he still might do. And he wanted to invest some smarts into getting to Mars. And mm-hmm. he created this compact machine to take pictures and roam around Mars called a lander rover.
Oh,
NASA took his design and they landed it on Mars, and they called it lander rover.
Oh, that's amazing.
So his expertise, I mean, he's endlessly fascinated by science and technology and creation. His expertise moves beyond the movies.
Mm-hmm.
But when you apply that to the movies, you're going to see something that you've never seen before.
Yeah, that's one of the things I like about James Cameron. He's not just a filmmaker. He's kind of like an explorer in a way.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
That's a good analogy. That's a really good, that's a great one.
I think that's his love of underwater diving and the deep sea expeditions that he's done, and going down to the Titanic debris, and I think that calls upon his kind of Jacques Cousteau kind of mentality too.
He is like that. He is like that Cousteau in a way, but in the movie world, he's kind of like him in a way, Cousteau.
Yeah.
Yeah. He is.
Yeah. And even with Avatar, he doesn't know. He has no idea if it can be done, and he goes to work every day. He said, and he says, this has never been done before. I don't know what I'm doing. And he's as expert a filmmaker in making these big event films as anyone. And it's exhilarating for him to not quite know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, he has very much explorer qualities as well.
Exactly.
He's an unknown depth. So what's your name again, sir?
It's Ike from OSLCX, the Old School Losers Club Radio.
Yes, you tune into our show a lot, and I appreciate it. I
we
see
do,
you on here.
Thank you very much.
I appreciate it very much, Ike.
Anytime.
All right, buddy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, let's play Stephen Lang, and then we'll close off the Avatar show. I just want to tell everyone, Sunday night show, the Golden Globe nominations have been announced, so we're going to have a roundtable where we predict the winners. That's always a fun time.
Mm-hmm.
And we're also going to have writer-director Jody Markell and actress Ellen Burstyn from the new movie The Loss of a Teardrop Diamond. And Ellen Burstyn, you talk about somebody that's worked with some of the great filmmakers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you
The Exorcist and Requiem for a Dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, everyone. She's great.
Scorsese, and yeah, it's going to be a good time. So that's Sunday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Our next guest, our final guest, is actor Stephen Lang. He is an accomplished actor of the stage and screen, whose credits include Gettysburg, Tombstone, Last Exit to Brooklyn, The Hard Way.
I
laugh at The Hard Way because I love it so much. And actually, Chris and I, our other movie geek, Chris, we laugh about The Hard Way all the time because we like it. And that scene with Stephen Lang where he's talking back to the TV screen to James Woods, like,
yeah.
me to you. It's corny. He was also in Public Enemies.
He was actually
recently.
Very good. I liked him in Public Enemies. I thought he was very
yeah.
good.
Yeah, really. In Avatar, he plays Colonel Miles Quaritch. And here he talks to us about his experience working with two of the most demanding filmmakers back-to-back in Michael Mann and James Cameron, and the unique challenges that he faced playing within the Avatar universe. Here's Stephen Lang. I'm wondering, how did this opportunity come about for you?
I was doing a play in New York, a play I wrote. It's a solo performance about the Medal of Honor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, there was an ad every day in the Times. There's kind of a picture of me, sort of a macho picture.
Right.
And Jim Cameron, who was, you know, knee-deep in Avatar back in 07, saw it and remembered that we'd had a meeting some years ago, and I received a call saying, that Jim Cameron would like you to read a script.
Wow.
And I said, okay. Okay. And I read it, and I thought it was pretty remarkable. And then we had a, you know, a long talk on the phone. And I ended up, you know, after my final performance of the week on a Sunday afternoon, went out and met up with him at his place, and we talked and worked for an hour or so, and that was it. And he asked me to do the role, so that's,
you know,
how,
and you've,
it worked.
You've played several military men.
Yeah.
Do you come from that background? Were you in the military yourself, or is this something you just fell into as an actor?
Well, I was not in the military. I think if circumstances in life had been different, I might have done that. I think I have a good head for it, you know. I think I respond to authority well, I think. But you know, I really like playing generals and colonels.
Yes.
Yeah. You know,
strong characters.
So
yeah.
I suppose you could say I like giving orders also. But,
right.
No, I mean, I figure I've ended up playing all these military guys because I have good posture and no other reason, basically.
I'm sure it's more than that. I look over your resume, and you've been in so many films that I love, and you've given great performances in all of them, and you know, I see that you switch from big screen to TV to stage very frequently, and your stage credits are impeccable. That must be a dream for a working actor to be able to switch between all those different formats of performance.
Yeah, I suppose it is. It's been an interesting career, and at this point it's been fairly lengthy, I guess. I think that I always felt that for a long time I got roles that people didn't really know what to do with them, whether it was on, you know, whatever the medium was. It's nice to be able to bounce back and forth. And one tends to make you miss the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that you're, I mean, I'm very happy to be doing what I'm doing, but there was a period from about 03 through 07 where I might have done two films during that time. I was on stage the whole time. So
right.
Avatar came along at a really wonderful time. I was really ready to take a break from A to Week, you know.
Yeah.
And since then, I haven't done a play. And it's just the other day was, you know, less than a week ago, was the first time I sort of had an internal rumbling that was, I felt like working on stage again.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
You know, let's see. But, you know, things have I think that it's probably good that it works this way for me because there's just that much more in terms of opportunity, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm not just limited to one or the other. So I'm really thankful it's worked out that way.
Amongst the last few movies that you've done, the last two movies that we've seen you in, you've worked under Michael Mann in Public Enemies,
right.
And now James Cameron in Avatar.
Right.
And from just an outsider's perspective as a big movie fan,
yeah.
They would seem to me to be similar personalities in their kind of meticulous nature. Do you find that the case?
Nobody works harder, I think, on a set. And by working hard, I really do mean focus and engagement, you know?
Yeah.
I think it's interesting also, and I'm not quite sure what to make of it, but I think it's very, very interesting that both of them tend to operate a lot, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they like to be behind the camera. So so there's a very, very intimate engagement with them. Jim told me one time, actually when I met him out in California, when he slung a camera up, he said, you know, I really think through the lens. I said, okay, great. So in those respects, I think they're similar. I think their worldviews are somewhat different, however, you know,
yeah.
which is interesting because I think that Michael, Well, I think Jim, if you look at his films, and I think if you look at Avatar, for all the subtleties that are in the film, I think the worldview or the difference, say, between the good guys and the bad guys is quite clear, you know? If you think of a film like Titanic, there's no mistaking where the sympathies lie, where an audience's sympathies are supposed to lie in that film, you know? It seems to me his bad guys tend to be pretty bad, although I put a footnote on that when it comes to Avatar, because, you know, I play what is, I guess, could be characterized as the villain of the piece, which I don't really, that's unplayable, so what does that mean to me? But what I was going to say then about Michael, I think Michael has a much more ambiguous worldview. And if you look at so many of his films, certainly Public Enemies, there's a tremendous amount of corruption on the sides of the law, ostensibly the good guys, and there's an awful lot of nobility and a sense of mission and righteousness on the sides of the criminals. It seems
true of something like Heat as well. When you have
exactly.
You know, they're both so similar in that they're so laser focused, but they're both sympathetic and they both lose so much because of what they do.
Yeah. And that's a theme that Michael has worked with before. I mean, I did a series called Crime Story with Michael.
Yeah.
And if you look at that, I mean, it's just there's a total ambiguity as to, you know, who's good and who's bad.
Yeah.
In that thing. So I think that it's a difference in world view there, different, maybe a difference in themes that sort of grab them. But that's thematic. You know, that's not, we're not talking about the way to work. But in terms of working, they're both extremely demanding, and I find it a lot of fun because they both just demand, not by saying it, but just by example, that you come fully loaded.
Well, you mentioned something that I actually had a question about, which is that they both operate the camera largely.
Yeah.
How does that assist you as an actor when the director is right there in your face, essentially, as opposed to, you know, off in a distance watching it on a monitor?
Well, it can be, if you're working in, say, performance capture, it can be a extremely intimate relationship because he may be talking during the take. I mean, it becomes something of a duet between yourself and the director or camera. The same can be true of Michael, who will kind of annotate or, you know, takes in a way. And so to me, it becomes very much, I guess the word I would use is there's sort of an intimacy to it. You know, you're not, then there are other times just because circumstantially, you know, he's 50 yards away. You know, that can happen as well. But a lot of times when the camera's right there, there's not a lot between you and your director.
Yeah. You mentioned loving the script, obviously, that you were sent. And I've read quotes from other actors that read Cameron's scripts and say that they don't necessarily read like any other screenplays they've received. Is there something unique about him as a writer actually reading his scripts? How do they read for you?
Well, you know, he's very well schooled. He's very well steeped, I'd say, in literature, both in classical literature and I think in science. Mm-hmm. And so there's a real there's a kind of a certainty and an authority that one reads in the script. I think he delineates characters very, very clearly. And when I read Avatar, he described a world that is impossible, right? I mean, he described a world that doesn't exist as we know it. And yet, and this is something I never even considered at the time, it never I never, ever doubted the fact that this would be brought to life, you know? And that's not just because I have confidence in the technology or that confidence in Jim as a director. I think it has to do with the authority of the writing. You know, when you read any great piece of, literature, it doesn't matter whether it's sci-fi, fantasy, or just classical literature. I mean, when you read War and Peace, you're there. You know what it's. Tolstoy paints a very, very, very clear picture of it. And you have the reality, just as Tolkien does. He creates an imaginary world, which becomes very, very real in our imagination. And, I mean, it's a mark of really good writing that we associate much of the time with novelists, I think.
Yeah.
And I think that Jim did that very, very strongly in the screenplay, the descriptive. His powers of description are very, very strong, and you understand, I think, his characters at a glance, which is not to say that they're simple. It's just that they you go, okay, I know who this is. I feel this guy. I feel, yes. Oh, I see where she's coming from.
In terms of character and your character, you've mentioned that some people could classify him as the villain of the piece, but we always talk about the so-called villain as always the hero of their own story. So can you tell me a little bit about your character in this one?
Well, he's the head of security at Hell's Gate, which is the human compound on Pandora. And his mission is to basically keep people alive in a situation where that's extremely difficult. The odds are long on a daily basis. It's an unfriendly environment, and it's populated by unfriendly beings, or at least unfriendly to us. I think it's a he basically lives and breathes the mission, and I think he takes each breach of security, each loss, quite personally. He's very, very invested in his job. Mm-hmm. And I think to some extent he's defined by it, you know? And on paper, that what's wrong with that, you know?
Yeah.
He's trying to do what he was hired for, keep his people alive. But he's very interesting too, because his history comes out of he was served three tours in the Marines back on Earth in a future that we postulate as being one where the wars are even filthier and dirtier than they are now. Mm. Okay, I think that the sales pitch, the reason one joins in the first place, you know, there's talk about when people would see old Randolph Scott movies or something back in 1941 or something, they'd rush off to join the Marines, and the reality was quite different than the reason they joined. I think people join, and I think Quart certainly joins up because of this this desire to this internal need for to perform with honor, to do duty, to display courage, to all these positive attributes, and quite idealistic. And I think the reality is quite different. And I think that can have a really deadening effect on the soul. Mm. I think at some point, you know, enough death and destruction, enough lack of the total absence of any kind of legitimate rules of engagement can breed a cynicism in you, and which I think is the most deadly of all characteristics of you can have, because it's kind of what it means to me is an absence of hope,
mm-hmm.
you know? And I think that he just lives for for the job. And he lives for, he's defined by his own ability to do the job.
Well, you're talking about all of the character attributes and all the work you do to build a character. And I would think as an actor, when you go on a set, especially one as big as Avatar, it probably takes you a little while to find your footing. Was there a moment in the shooting where you thought, oh, okay, yes, I have this guy?
I think that there's almost, well, in a sense, there's not time for that, and in a sense, there's all the time in the world for that. So what do I mean? I mean, I remember very well the first scenes that I shot for it were in the Armor Bay, which is a great place for me because it's kind of my home, mm-hmm. you know, as Quaritch. And I felt ready. I felt prepared, and at the same time, you know, you're so adrenalized you know, maybe there's too much break on your curveball, or you're throwing so much heat that you're wild, and it takes a little while to kind of just develop the kind of work sweat that you need to get into a rhythm. But you know, I mean, not to sound like an old fart or anything, I've been doing this for so long that that's familiar to me. You know what I mean? This mm-hmm. sort of feeling, okay, I got to get in the groove now, and with Jim and with Sam, who I was working with on those first days, it was very, it came about quite naturally. But I do remember that a lot of the first stuff I did involved my amp suit, which is my armored mobile platform, which is kind of an extension of myself. And it's a big, you know, the sucker's like 14 feet tall, and you got to scramble up the side of it. And I spent days and days before that just climbing in and out of that beast, familiarizing myself so I could strap in, so I could get it going. So I felt totally at home, or I looked like I was totally at home in that suit. And yeah. So that was, and you know, a lot of times if you can, what I was talking about before, you know, in terms of the depth of the character and everything, there's not much you're going to do with that. Either, you know, that stuff you talk about, you decide about, and it's there or it's not there. But there are certain mechanical tasks, which is really what I like to focus on when I act, because the other stuff, you've grounded yourself in it, and presumably it'll take care of itself, you know? Mm. But when it comes down to, you know, I have to get this body roll correct, I have to ride this horse as if I've been riding every day for the past 30 years, as if I were born on one. I have to operate this amp suit as if it's an extension of my arms and legs, my entire body. So that kind of stuff is all really doable, because it's a very material task, and that's the way I went at it. This role, yeah.
Well,
I remember it was really important to me. I wanted to be able to. I remember firing off my weapon at one point, and I'm talking to, you know, a squad at the same time as I'm reloading, which means I'm reloading. You know, so I got to be able to reload this sucker without ever looking down at it. You know, you know, and I mean, it just goes without saying that I know what I'm going to say to these guys, which is really the point of the scene, right? I mean, what I'm talking about, what I'm communicating. But to me, the object is, you know, to reload as if it's second nature and everything. I like to focus on tasks like that.
Well, isn't it kind of, I think I've heard it before, action is character?
Yeah. I mean, and character is, and story is character, too. I mean, character is defined by it. I mean, I don't know. I suppose, yes, action, lack of. Whatever, that's what you use to define it, the speed with which you move, what you're doing. I would say that necessity is character, and what I would mean by that is, like, you know, the crucial question that I would ask in any scene is, what do I need? Mm-hmm. What do I need? Do I need a drink of water? Do I need to be slapped? Do I need some sleep? You know, do I need to be loved? What do I need? Well, as long as you keep it, you don't always come up with the answer. But to me, that's what defines the character is kind of necessity.
You're, with Avatar, this is, I would imagine, the most special effects kind of heavy project you've done.
Mm-hmm.
What's that different discipline? I would think that it calls upon your imagination entirely, more so than most other projects might.
It does, except when it doesn't. I mean, one of the last things, yes, you're right. When you're in command of your dragon warship and you've got 1,000 screaming banshees all around you, then you're thrown upon your imagination.
Mm-hmm.
to a very large extent, and for sure. On the other hand, I mean, I remember, you know, one day Jim says, Slang, is it cool if we incinerate you today? yeah, sure, man, absolutely. And, you know, so they build a fire on my shoulder. So there was nothing imaginative about that. It was like, you know, okay, I got a fire going on my shoulder. You know, let's roll, and then when we're done, I'll put the fire out, and then we'll light it again, and we'll do it again. So it was a never-ending, it was great. There was all kinds of different ways of going about that. There was a very varied kind of approach on this film, because there's live action, there's stuff that's a combination of live action and performance capture, there's straight performance capture, there's a ton of green screen. It was really what do we got today, you know?
Wow. How much of it have you seen?
I've seen it. The film.
Oh, you've seen the finished product.
Well, I haven't seen it in 6 weeks or so, which means that it's more finished than when I did see it. But, yes, I have seen it. Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty glorious. But I haven't seen it on the humongous screen yet. I mean, I've seen it 3D, but I haven't seen it on a, you know, IMAX screen. So I'm looking forward to that.
The big question about the film is it a game changer? And I guess that refers to the technology, and do you feel a new era with this film somehow?
Well, I guess you're talking about the whole, is that the 3D aspect?
Well, the whole
about, or?
The whole experience of it. We've heard you've never seen this.
Yeah.
This film before, this environment before, this can be a real path to what the future of movies might look like.
Well, I suppose that can be true, but I would also, I remember when I saw T2,
mm-hmm.
And they had that amazing thing where he sort of melted or got all silvery or something. You remember, you know what I'm talking about? He did this morphing thing. And I'd never seen that before, and I don't think it had been done before. And I swear to God, within 2 months, I saw it in a Pepto-Bismol commercial. It's the same thing. So to me, the question, I'm not sure that the question's one thing, but I do know that as an audience, as a species, we are incredibly, we adapt very, very quickly. And the appetite for something new is kind of never ending. So I think what becomes, you know, a game changer, as it were, what becomes this remarkable thing, will gain acceptance, will become a norm very, very quick, or one of the norms, because there's still, you know, there are plenty of films that will just be not made that way, but we'll always, you know, we're always going to have an appetite for something new. So in that sense, I mean, you know, I guess you're always going to have people out there who are kind of pushing the envelope on the technology. But in the end, it's all about story.
Yeah,
and that's it. I mean, that, you know, end of story. Because if you can have, you know, the most game changing kind of technology in the world, and unless you've got a great story, a classic story, you're not going to have a great or a classic film. You're going to have something. But I think, you know, what you really want to do is you want to make something remarkable. I know that that's what Jim Cameron and John Landau set out to do, is to make something truly remarkable. And the technology is a servant of that, it seems to me, you know, because finally what it's about is a story with characters that people really, really care about and want to see more of.
That's what I think has been missing from the dialogue, and I'm sure it'll come up once people start to see the film, is that all the technology's fine, but unless the film moves you or you're invested in the story or the characters in some way, the movie's not going to last no matter what technology is behind it. So, and Cameron is a master storyteller. I mean, he's the best at that.
Yeah, that's it. That's the deal right there.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
That's the way I see it. That's the way I've seen it. I mean, when I think of the films that I love, the films that have stayed with me forever, it's totally got to do with a story that had me on the edge of my seat no matter how many times, you know, I see it.
Yeah.
Which I can watch endlessly just to watch the nuances of the way the story is told.
Mm. Well, I cannot wait. This is I've been salivating over this for so long. So
yeah.
I appreciate your time so much, and let's do it again, and when we can talk more about performance and about the remainder of your career.
Excellent. Anytime. Always happy to. Always
Thank
happy
you.
To talk about me.
All right. That's actor Stephen Lang. He is in Avatar, which opens December 18th. So, Jerry, final prediction. There are two final predictions.
Oh, what, all right. In the sense of what? How much
will
it
be?
Or
do you think it'll be the highest grossing movie of 2010?
Yes.
It would have to be Transformers 2.
I think it can do that.
Pray to God.
I really do think it can do that. Now, what's the other prediction?
Do you think an Oscar for Best Picture is in its future?
I think a nomination, definitely. I think this is going to be a very exciting race because it's going to be Bigelow against Cameron.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's going to be the most exciting race. I mean, and Tarantino's going to probably be in there, maybe Eastwood, I'm not sure, but it's going to be a very exciting race.
Well, we're going to be talking about Avatar a lot. I mean, we're not done talking about it because we have the Golden Globe predictions on Sunday. The Oscar noms announced February 2nd. The Oscar
and
show
Jason
March
O'Brien's,
7th. Oscar show, yeah. And so this won't be the last we hear of Avatar, and we'll be back Sunday night also with our review of Avatar.
Yeah.
After we get a chance to see it. All right, buddy, I enjoyed it.
And likewise. Now, let me ask you this one final question, though. If you like it, I have a feeling this is going to be one of those movies that, given the technology and everything, it probably be like two or three times you'll see it in the theater over the course of its run, if it's really good, which I think it will be. So I definitely see going back and seeing it a couple times.
Yes.
I mean, definitely.
Because it's an experience.
And, yeah, it really is.
And just like people go on rides more than one time because they want to relive that experience.
Right.
So I think that's a safe bet with it, yeah. All right, dude, we'll be back Sunday night. We appreciate everyone listening tonight, either live or on the archive. And Avatar, go
Avatar,
see it.
Avatar, baby.
As if we have to convince you more.
Good night, everyone.
Good night.